Everybody please open up to Leviticus chapter 16. When I get powered up here, we'll be in Leviticus and we'll be looking at chapter 16 tonight for quite a while. But, here we go. I got the slides coming on. I just got to get the TV on. Okay. Okay, so this is our 12th class studying the law specifically in the two books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. We are at this point about halfway through the book of Leviticus. We had a fairly lengthy couple lessons, you know, introductory material. And now we're working our way through Leviticus fairly rapidly. It is a book, as we've said so many times, that is so very specifically devoted to the function of the priests in the old Mosaic sacrificial system, which nobody's practiced for 2,000 years, that this great detail then is important, because God would not have caused it to be recorded permanently for the use of Christians if he didn't think we should be studying it. He's choosing which books are going to be in the Bible. So I don't mean at all to denigrate or demean or diminish somehow the information. But at the same time, it does not relate as directly to us, at least, because it's not being practiced. It's not a thing that we're going to be absolutely using. So I've been going fairly quickly through the outline that I've shown you several times now. First seven chapters we've already covered. There are five what we'll call primary sacrifices that are set right at the beginning of the book of Leviticus. So you get information over the course of those seven chapters on those five sacrifices. I'm not going to review any of that tonight. In chapters 8 through 10, you then have a historical narrative about the institution of the priesthood itself. They're about a year or so into the wilderness wanderings. They're at the foot of Mount Sinai. They've been given all this instruction about both the law and the tabernacle. The tabernacle's been built, and so they're good to go for the next 39 years in the wilderness. And so the priesthood now can be inaugurated and start to function. So in chapters 8 through 10, we have that information, all the cleansing and dedication and sacrifices, and then the terrible failure of Aaron's two sons, Nadab and Abihu, who from the get-go, apparently on the first day, would not simply accept what God taught. They used in their incense something other than the recipe that God had determined, and they both lost their lives because of it. We're going to tie back into that again tonight when we actually get to chapter 16, which will be starting in just a moment. It's a little bit surprising to me that chapter 16 didn't follow immediately on 10, but then again, I can also see why it wouldn't. So you'll see the tie-in, though, here in a little bit. We finished chapters 11 through 15 last week, looked at a lot of listings of things that are clean and unclean. We spent a whole week thinking about dietary things, worked into some others last week. And so tonight we're coming to the Day of Atonement, a single chapter devoted to that one single day of sacrifice and of angst, as you'll see in a minute. And then we'll be taking up chapter 17 through 26, which uses the term holy. I'll give you some statistical information about that. That seems to be the running theme throughout these chapters, even though the word doesn't appear in chapter 17, okay, at all. So I'm torn, and I guess everybody is. Tonight we're going to look at chapter 16 and 17. Again, I understand why it can be separated, and so you think of it as being quite distinct. But really, it seems to me that it also has very direct ties to chapter 16, so I'd prefer very much to keep the two together. So in your note-taking, in your notes in your Bibles, if you want to link those two somehow, I think it would be wise to try to keep them together under most circumstances. But then especially after that, you start going down through these chapters, and again, similar to distinguishing between the clean and the unclean, we are going to be talking about what is holy and how they are to be holy. So, with all of that spilled out upon you with great haste, let's take up then the topic for the evening, which is, as the Jews would call it, Yom Kippur. You'll hear often, if you know any Jews, if you just watch the news, every year, at least on the news, there'll be some reference to it, you'll probably pick up Yom Kippur. We call it the Day of Atonement. But in Hebrew, of course, Yom Kippur, this is a tremendously important day. It is a very unusual day. It is a very high and holy day. And so it does stand alone with its own chapter here. But as you'll see, I've just added to the top of that slide, while the entirety of Leviticus 16 is devoted to the Day of Atonement, chapter 23 also has seven verses that are on this day. So in your Bibles or in your note-taking at Leviticus 16, be sure you jot down to see also Leviticus 23, which we'll look at this evening, and verses 26 through 32. Leviticus 23, 26 through 32. Now, in the book of Numbers, you've also got five more verses on the topic. So add there to your lists Numbers chapter 29, verses 7 through 11. We will, of course, look at those as well. So it's not a lot of verses to add to chapter 16, and then hopefully we'll get through 17 as well. Now, one more note for you down at the bottom of the slide here now. Just to get started, what does this term Yom Kippur mean in Hebrew? What does it mean in English? What is the day about, then? What's being accomplished? Yom Kippur means to cover or to cancel. That's the word, to cover or to cancel. Now, immediately we recognize we're talking about the covering of sin, the canceling out of sin. But also immediately and right at the outset, we want to, you know, take note that there would be very few of what you would think of as specially designated sacred religious words. Like baptism, which just means immerse, and occurs in several places, you know, got nothing to do with a religious activity that, you know, brings us into Christ. Yom Kippur is not a formal title with capital letters that can only be used for the Day of Atonement. It means to cover or to cancel. Now, last week's bulletin and the bulletin before that, I've been trying to use bulletin articles that tie in what we've been doing here on Wednesday nights. So this is the title from March 17th that was on, you know, the top of our bulletin, and of the article itself, which was written by Paul Earnhardt. It was called Sin's Costly Solution. Now, Paul Earnhardt is a great preacher, and I have articles from him that you've been seeing here recently that are, you know, truly great. And I particularly like this one. So if you're new among us, you're visiting with us, you'll be able to find those bulletins in a stack out there, you know, in the foyer on the table. The stack that's closest to the front of that table is next Sunday's bulletin. So it's like getting in a time machine. And then the big stack behind it, there'll be however many were left over from the printing every Sunday. So you might have 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or 30, depending on how many people came, you know, that Sunday. That'll be last Sunday, you know, on top. The next Sunday before that underneath, and then just dig down through the pile. But if you'd like to read the whole article, you're looking for March 17th. In that article, I've lifted just this one paragraph for you to see again tonight. Paul very succinctly gave us information about the word atonement that I thought I'd just read for you here this evening again. So this is a long quote from Paul Earnhardt. The remarkable reconciling of God's righteousness and God's love in the salvation of human beings finds its expression in the Old Testament word atonement. Its root idea is a covering. And it's used in this sense in Genesis 6:14 when God tells Noah to cover the ark with pitch. So that wasn't anything holy or, you know, or it wasn't anything religious or ceremonial, but he was told to slather that pitch on, you know, to the ark, and this word is what was employed to tell him to do that. So it just means to cover what's being covered, how the thing's being covered, the results of the covering. All of that is left to the context. I inserted into Paul's quote. End Paul's not quote, begin Paul's quote again. So its root idea is a covering. And it's used in this sense in Genesis 6:14 when God tells Noah to cover the ark with pitch. From this original meaning, it came to be applied to the covering over or forgiveness of sins, as in Psalm 65, verse 3. Atonement is a shield against the righteous anger of God towards sin. So see Numbers chapter 16, verses 41 through 46 on that concept. In the Old Testament church, an animal's blood was poured out instead of the blood of the one who transgressed God's law. This animal served as an atonement or covering for sin, which we'll be seeing in chapter 17, verse 11 here in a little bit. And for centuries, reminded Israel that sin was a serious business. And in spite of God's mercy upon the transgressor, his righteousness exacted a serious penalty. End quote. And all of my insertions. So, great article there, Sin's Costly Solution from Paul Earnhardt. And so important for us to remember, beyond just the definitions, and the covering and all of that, this particular day is utterly unique, as we're about to read in the Jewish seasons and in annual activities. It is a big, big deal. And it is a day in which they are to be unhappy. As you'll see, it is the only time that the Jews are ever ordered by God to fast. It is the only day of fasting in your Old Testament or New that is required. And that day is to be a day of sorrow and penitence, of grieving and just distress. It is an entire day that is devoted to trying to help these people really focus and at length in 4 hours, not four F-O-U-R, but 4 hours and hours on how bad sin is and how it separates us from God, how sacrifices and all have to be offered. This is the focal point of the year for the Jews, this Day of Atonement. So now, since we're going to be heading on into Leviticus 16 and 17, and throughout 16, this is the high priest, the only one who can go into the Holy of Holies ever, and then only on this day, one time a year, is depicted in this artist's rendition here with the censer that he's going to be taking in. And in what we're told, then that much smaller room back there would be entirely filled with the aroma and the smoke of this censer when he enters. So it would be a very smoky environment when he actually goes in behind this curtain to the Holy of Holies. And then, of course, you have the Ark of the Covenant there. Now you have here an incense altar, the table of showbread, and then the lampstand that's in the holy place. Outside the tabernacle itself is the laver, which is sometimes called the sea, the S-E-A, but is that bowl for washing in, large, priest washing in it. And then in front of everything, and closest to the entrance to the tabernacle enclosure, is, of course, the sacrificial altar itself. Now, the animals would have been killed outside. They've been brought in now, and sacrificed, burned upon that altar. But we're going to be reading about these things in Luke 16. So what I thought what I'd do tonight is, this was the best one I thought I could find for quality, and I know it's still kind of fuzzy, but I'm zooming in as far as I can just to get all these articles in view there. And then I'm just going to leave this on up now while we read through this evening's passages. So we're going to start now with Leviticus 16. You can see it's a fairly large chapter. It's got 34 verses. Not a lot of commentary necessary or even possible, because I can't explain what no one's ever seen, what we hear about here, but would never even be able to recreate if we wanted to do it again. And so there's always going to be some mystery. I believe God did that intentionally. It's written in this manner so that it served those people well. It was never going to be practiced. After the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the temple was torn down, not one stone left on another. We, therefore, are prevented, anybody that would want to try to bring this thing, back into service again. It's impossible, because God did not leave behind enough of a record to get it going again, now 2,000 years later, nearly. But still, this is, as so many things are in the Old Testament, figurative, symbolic. intended to be a type that will have an anti-type in the New Testament, and this certainly does. And so we will not spend so much time tonight looking at the parallels in the New Testament. We're just going to read fairly rapidly and try to descend into the Jewish culture. Try to put yourself back there. Try to imagine for 1,500 years, beginning with this tabernacle, which is movable, and then in the temple itself, which was not, you know, what this day would mean to those people, because it's intended still to move us to appreciation, understanding, respect, a proper evaluation of the enormity of sin. In verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they had approached the presence of the Lord and died. Well, there's our connector. That's Leviticus 10. Now, verse 2, though, the Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. Now, I don't know what this means. Nobody does. How would God appear? What was the thing that the high priest would see? Is it only smoke that would be rising? Or is it something else in between smoke and what Moses saw when he spoke with God face to face, or even the very thing that Moses saw, although he doesn't come out with a glowing face, so that's highly unlikely. But what does he see? I don't know. But this is interesting. When he says, I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat, that has to be one extremely excited and terrified guy who goes through that veil. He is about to behold, in some extremely heightened and personal sense, and in a very small room, God Himself in some form. That does not happen with any other sacrifice. In verse 3, Aaron shall enter the holy place with this, with a bull for a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen tunic. I've, you know, zoomed in so he can't see it. You saw it the preceding slide there, but the special attire. Put on the holy linen tunic, and the linen undergarments shall be next to his body. He shall be girded with the linen sash and attired with the linen turban. These are holy garments. Then he shall bathe his body in water and put them on. He shall take from the congregation of the sons of Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Then, you know, see chapters 1 through 7 on what those offerings, you know, in detail are. Verse 6. Then Aaron shall offer the bull for the sin offering, which is for himself, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So the doorway of the tent of meeting is this sacrificial area here. And so then it says in 8, and Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats. One lot for the Lord. So that goat's for the Lord. And the other lot for the what? Scapegoat. Does everybody's translation, whatever you have, say scapegoat? And we all know what a scapegoat is, don't we? And why do we know what a scapegoat is? Because of this passage, okay, which goes back approximately 3,500 years. The word itself is Azazel, and again, has to do with covering. But it is now, you know, or excuse me, that's incorrect. It is removal. The idea in the actual word that's used there is removal. So now we have two things that are associated with this day. We have covering or canceling, and then we have removal. Now, those of you already familiar with the chapter, you know what's going to happen to that goat that's dedicated for the Lord, don't you? He's going to leave, and with him the sins are going to be removed. But when something or someone else takes the rap for what you did, then that is the scapegoat. People are always looking for a scapegoat. Since the Mueller report came out, we have never seen so much scapegoat looking for in the past couple of days. Everybody blaming everybody if you've been following the news. So, we know what a scapegoat is, but we know it from this. Then, in verse 9, Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot for the Lord fell, make it a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell for the scapegoat fell shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it, to send it into the wilderness as the scapegoat. Then Aaron shall offer the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, make atonement for himself and for his household. He shall slaughter the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and he shall take a fire pan full of coals of fire, which is what killed his two sons. He shall take a fire pan full of coals of fire from upon the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of finely ground sweet incense, and bring it inside the veil. He shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the ark of the testimony, lest he die. So he puts it in the censer that he brought in with him. Fire, you know, coals in there, and that's how he's going to burn the incense. But if he doesn't, what happens in the last three words of verse 13? You die here now instantaneously. Then verse 14. Moreover, he shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side. Also in front of the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. Then he shall slaughter the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil. Now, brother doesn't say so, but there's a classic example when we talk about command, example, and necessary inference. Here's the necessary inference. He went in there and did this blood sprinkling. Now he's got to go out, doesn't he? But does it say he goes out? No, but that's the necessary inference. So he's now got to go out and slaughter a goat. And then that's for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil. So now he's back in a second time and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull. Sprinkle it on the mercy seat and in front of the mercy seat. He shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the sons of Israel and because of their transgressions in regard to all their sins. And thus he shall do for the tent of meeting, which abides with them in the midst of their impurities. Now you're beginning to get the point that we might be ought to think about impurities a bit here. Yeah. So now in 17, when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place, no one shall be in the tent of meeting until he comes out. So while every day there's going to be priests in the holy place, in front of the Holy of Holies, this day, what? Clear them out. Isn't going to be anybody in there. And so, until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household and for all the assembly of Israel. 18. Then he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it. So now he's back outside again, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar on all sides. And with his finger he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it seven times and cleanse it from the impurities of the sons of Israel. And from the impurities of the sons of Israel, consecrate it. 20. When he finishes atoning for the holy place and the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall offer the live goat. Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat. Confess over it all the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all their transgressions in regard to all their sins. He shall lay them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who stands in readiness. Now, New Testament connections, we're not going to look at them, but we're going to find out this is going to be symbolizing, of course, the removal of these sins. And then a tie-in is going to be made to Jesus having to suffer and die, what? Outside the city. We're sending the goat outside the city. We're removing this sin. That scapegoat is going to go as far away as we can get it. It's not to be among us with all this impurity. We're taking that impurity away. So then, in verse 21, Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities. And then we get three different expressions about him confessing all these iniquities. So what are they doing? Are they just keeping a list? Do we know? We don't know. So what does that mean? Is it left up to the high priest to compose some sort of statement every year? Is there one provided that isn't recorded for us? Is there some accounting being made of the sins that are, you know, being perpetrated? We have no idea. But there is this very formal moment, and it keeps to me emphasizing all. He has to go to some length to say, we want all of the sins of every kind that have been committed in this entire year to now, in this, my hands being laid upon that goat's head, be laid upon the goat. So that every sin of every imaginable kind, however large or small as we might tend to want to rank them, is going to be removed. Now then, in verse 21 again, but the last half, he'll lay them on the head of the goat and send it away in the wilderness by what? The hand of a man who stands in readiness. So there's a guy there that will receive this goat. It's not just going to be turned loose to wander around. It's going to be taken out east into the Judean wilderness so far away that it won't find its way back. So this man's got a big trip on his hands. 22. The goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to a solitary land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. Then Aaron shall come into the tent of meeting. How many times is that now? It's three now. Take off the linen garment, not into the Holy of Holies though, but now back to the tent of meeting, and take off the linen garments which he put on when he went into the holy place, and shall leave them there. He shall bathe his body with water in a holy place, put on his clothes, come forth and offer his burnt offering, the burnt offering of the people, make atonement for himself and for the people. He starts all over again, kind of, doesn't he, with all this atonement. Then he shall offer up in smoke the fat of the sin offering on the altar. The one who released the goat as the scapegoat shall wash his clothes and bathe his body with water, and afterward shall come into the camp. But the bull of the sin offering, the goat of the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be taken outside the camp. Again, outside the camp. Jesus will be outside the camp in the crucifixion. They shall burn their hides, their flesh, and their refuse in the fire. Then the one who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe his body with water, and afterward he shall come into the camp. And this shall be a permanent statute for you. In the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, which would be the end of our September somewhere, close to the end, you shall humble your souls and not do any work, whether the native or the alien who sojourns among you. For it is on this day that atonement shall be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean from all your sins before the Lord. It is to be a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, that you may humble your souls. It is a permanent statute. This has to do with just thinking of yourself in the lowest possible, you know, position and form before your God. You are to be humbled before Him in these events. Then, 32, so the priest who is anointed and ordained to serve as priest in his father's place shall make atonement. He shall thus put on the linen garments, the holy garments, make atonement for the holy sanctuary, and he shall make atonement for the tent of meeting and for the altar. He shall also make atonement for the priests and for all the people of the assembly. Now you shall have this as a permanent statute, to make atonement for the sons of Israel for all their sins once every year. And just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so he did. The first ever Day of Atonement. Now there's a bit more, as I told you, so turn over to chapter 23 and we'll start in verse 26. Leviticus 23, verse 26 through 32. Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on exactly the 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. What's a convocation? It's an assembly. So when the priest is going through all of this, the people are going to be gathered out of all of their tents. They're all going to surround the tabernacle and be a part of this, be a witness to all of this. You shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to the Lord. Neither shall you do any work on this same day, for it is a day of atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord your God. If there is any person who will not humble himself on this same day, he shall be cut off from his people. As for any person who does any work on this same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no work at all. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. It is to be a Sabbath of complete rest to you. You shall humble your souls on the 9th of the month at evening, from evening until evening. So there would be your 10th day. You shall keep your Sabbath. Now the last passage is over in Numbers chapter 29, verses 7 through 11. Numbers 29, 7. On the 10th day of this 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall humble yourselves. You shall not do any work. You shall present a burnt offering to the Lord as a soothing aroma. One bull, one ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old, having them without defect. Their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for the bull, 2/10 for the one ram, 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs, 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the sin offering of atonement, continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and their libations. So now, that one is a down-the-road particular Day of Atonement. And you saw a whole lot of sacrificing going on there that was not listed in chapter 16 or 23, was there? See, that's new stuff. It apparently also seems to be singular to that particular event. Okay? So, what do we have? This amazing day. A lot of animals are going to die. Animals are going to die for everybody. And in this one unusual event, there's also going to be an animal that doesn't die, but it must be removed. It's the scapegoat. In some of the artist's conceptions of the temple, once they get back to Jerusalem, Solomon builds, and then Hezekiah adds some, and eventually, of course, we're going to have Herod the Great involved. In some of those pictures, though I don't think yet, We are absolutely certain. There's historical records outside the Bible. I don't know that any archaeological artifacts have been found. But you will sometimes see an enormous, enormous bridge that goes from the eastern wall of the old city of Jerusalem, which happens coincidentally to also be the eastern wall of the Temple Mount, that heads due east and traverses the entire Kidron Valley. Landing out over there on the Mount of Olives then, it's believed that when they got to the final and full and permanent structure, that this was the route then that the scapegoat with his attendant leading him, would take. And they didn't even go down in the valley. They went straight out, and then down off the Mount of Olives, diving all the way down. You can go clear to the Dead Sea. And from there, you can go all the way to through the Negev and clear to Eilat, I guess, on the Gulf of Aqaba. So I don't know how far he took these things, but it was one long way. Now, I've rushed a little bit, but I am going to go ahead. I wanted you to see one thing here this evening. And I wasn't sure I'd have time for it. I see now that I do. We've still got room for Leviticus 17, but I want to show you a few more slides about how to envision this. Here's a great, interior cutaway again from a different artist here. I've cut off the verbiage, so I'm trying to read it. It was all around there, and I'm just trying to zoom in and everything. But again, when this priest goes in carrying a censer, special incense, fire, he's going to come in here past the table of showbread, past this lampstand, past the altar of incense. These things they got right here just to show that they had pillars, supporting this veil and all of that, so don't be confused. It's not anything that's used in sacrifice, just a cutaway. And then you've got your Holy of Holies in the back with the Ark of the Covenant, and of course then the mercy seat on the top. in this area, God is going to appear. There were three different kinds of fabrics or skins that were used to cover over the tabernacle. And I particularly like this one because they show then, you know, these different fabrics. We've got ones that's, you know, the interior you see, and then you've got three waterproof coverings that are over the top. I don't know, brethren, you know, what particularly to make out of this, except that it would be protection from the weather. They're going to be, you know, in the Sinai Peninsula for 39 years with this thing, and then many years after that, it will be in Israel. But isn't it interesting to think that on our Day of Atonement, where the word means what? Covering, that he's going into the tabernacle, as they often do out here every day, but now he gets in the inner place, he's going to actually meet God, somehow appears in that smoke over that mercy seat. But all this covering, you know, really comes to prominence on this particular day. So he's inside this building with four different layers of covering on the Day of Covering and sending out of the scapegoat. So there's your once a year Day of Atonement. Now what I was going to add to that then is that there's been a full-size model built. And apparently, it's as good as we're likely to find, at least on the earth today. So rather than an artist's conception, it's a full-size construction. So what I'm showing you right here, of course, is most of the Middle East. It is 260 miles from right there all the way down to here. That's the actual furthest point of Israel today. You probably can't see that yellow line right there, and then it runs all the way up to Jordan. But there's a point right there, that's Lebanon off to the side, and it runs alongside Lebanon and Syria there. 260 miles. This is a little town of Eilat. Now, as we zoom in, okay, here's just the tip now, that Gulf of Aqaba, and Eilat is right on the beach. It's a great tourist area, one of the more popular in the world, I suppose. The scuba diving there and the fish that you can see are just astonishing, and so every diver wants to go. It's 265 miles to the tip, 260 to Eilat, as I pointed out. And about 20 miles north of this northernmost end of the Gulf of Aqaba, in as deserty desert as you can ever imagine, there's a place called Timnah. And Timnah's really interesting. They found fortifications there that date back to the time of Solomon. Obviously, it would be a, you know, possible entrance point for invasions. So Solomon had a big fortified area. It was just inside, you know, off the waterfront there, about 20 miles. But in Timnah, there is a group that built this. They wanted it to be out in a wilderness setting, you know, and since Eilat is so popular, it became another tourist attraction. If they were going to go put it out, you know, in the Sinai, well, a lot of people go to what is thought to be Sinai and all that, yeah, epic. But, you know, the surroundings would be extremely similar nonetheless. But this is a life-size, according to the dimensions given in Scripture, approximation, reconstruction of what the enclosure and all that would have looked like. Now, bear in mind that, again, you can't reproduce it. So it's the best that they can do. But here is, you know, a bit of a close-up now. So when we think about it, does this surprise you? Isn't it smaller? It surprises me that it's just smaller than I was thinking it was going to be. So it's not a really big structure by any means. The enclosure itself is not all that big. Here is, you know, just inside the enclosure there, you know, and somebody standing, so you get a view of what it would have looked like, you know, past the altar, the laver, and on into the holy place, and then the Holy of Holies at the far end. And then, I liked this one because we were just talking about the covering. You know, those coverings, they rolled them back now, so they've got, you know, just the structure itself. But apparently it was sloped, and so it would drain, and had this waterproofing material right there. And so here again, I just put this one in to give you the scale. It's a tourist location, you know, people got a camera strap over shoulder there, you know, so you can go inside and you can look at all of these things. But when you get down in there and you try to imagine so many sacrifices and constantly going on, you know, and so much activity, you might have thought that it was a much larger place, but apparently it's not necessary. This is what God wanted. This would handle everything that needed to be done for all of those years. Remember, we've already read about the grate, and how the altar itself was set up. You could keep the fire underneath, and so you'd be working feverishly and all day long to get these sacrifices first slaughtered and then consumed. And then here is inside the holy place. So your table of showbread, best as we can imagine from dimensions given, the lampstand, the altar of incense, and then the final veil that you'd be passing through. Now, I want to get just a close-up for a second. They're showing some ideas on utensils. This is, maybe a fire pan, and then there's just a variety of things that they're working with there. The four horns on the altar, as they suppose they may have appeared. So close-ups. But these are all shots taken from Tim there, where I've never been. I haven't been there myself. And then I kind of like this mercy seat. We all are just so interested in these angelic beings that are somehow over it and their wings are touching. I've seen dozens, I guess, of artist renditions. But the way they did this one, just in kind of a kneeling manner, and showing that humility and everything. And then, of course, they're lighting the inside there. But this mercy seat, that's a full-size, mercy seat. And God's presence was there throughout the course of the Mosaic Law. Now, the last photo, and then we'll go to Leviticus 17. I barely have time here, but we'll make it. This one, of course, is from the Day of Atonement, but note that it's now imagining that we've come to the Promised Land, and Solomon now has built his temple and all of that. But they're showing the scapegoats, or the two goats, rather, there. You don't want to be selected with the lots to go for the scapegoat. So, envisioning this, I hope, I trust, is always very helpful. We try to get as close to the scriptures as we can, but we won't have any more slides. And we've got a fascinating, much shorter chapter in chapter 17. And as I've suggested, I think should be tied to 16. So let's roll on through here, chapter 17. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel and say to them, this is what the Lord has commanded, saying, any man from the house of Israel who slaughters an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or who slaughters it outside the camp, and has not brought it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to present it as an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guiltiness is to be reckoned to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. The reason is so that the sons of Israel may bring their sacrifices, which they were sacrificing in the open field, that they may bring them into the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting to the priest and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to the Lord." Now, all you Old Testament scholars, okay, dig deep now and think now about all the years to come, in your Old Testament. See if you can dig out an expression that arises because of the failure of the people to obey this command. Where were the sacrifices frequently being offered? I hear the murmur, but I don't hear the words. High hills, it's the high hills. So every time these people started walking away from the temple so that the sacrifices are not offered where they belong, at the temple later or the tabernacle now, soon as they start moving off and offering their sacrifices out in camp and outside here and there and in the field and everywhere else, what have they just said? Care what God says. And apparently, we're going to have to read between the lines, what are they thinking? Oh, it's too much trouble. It's a big journey, and all of that. And it's just as good, after all, God is everywhere. We could worship Him in the woods if we want. Okay? The old arguments we all hear today now. Okay? So, we don't like organized religion today. People are still doing this exact same thing. And what they're saying is, I am more important than God. My convenience counts more than anything else. And when I find stuff in Scripture that kind of interrupts my daily flow, then I'll just rewrite it and do something different, and it'll be okay. God won't mind. Shades of two guys that we should have already learned taught this lesson. Who are their, what are their names? Nadab and Abihu. God had to go out of his way immediately, even with the Day of Atonement, to tell these people, don't think you could just go do whatever you want. You cannot. Blood guiltiness, cut off. Now, 6. The priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of the Lord at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Offer up the fat in smoke as a soothing aroma to the Lord. They shall no longer offer sacrifice. They shall no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the goat demons with which they play the harlot. How in the world could they be worshiping goats? Oh, but they were. And of course, by the time we get to Caesarea Philippi, Pan is the chief goat god that the Christians will be facing from the get-go up there in the New Testament. Now, 8. Then you shall say to them, any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to offer it to the Lord, that man also shall be cut off from his people. Now, I've mentioned this before, those of you that have been with us for a while. It is so hard, and this is one of those occasions where you just really can't tell. Is it a capital offense? Does cut off mean die? Sometimes the term is used, and in the context it's explained carefully. It means kill is a capital offense. But it's not explained here, and it doesn't always mean that you have to die. It does mean that you have to go be a scapegoat, in the sense that you need to leave. Bill?
In the beginning of the chapter, when it's talking about killing these animals, is it talking about the ones that they ate for food or only sacrifices?
No. Oh, are you asking every time they kill any animal of any kind?
Yeah.
No. What's happening is they're saying, I'm dedicating this sacrifice. I'm trying to obey Moses' law. Here's the statute, but I'm just not going to take it to Jerusalem. I'm going to do it here at home. So it was a formal sacrifice. All the ones we've seen described in this book, these are the ones he's referencing. Those that must come to the temple, he knew people were going to start just doing them at home. Okay, now we want to close, though, with verses 10 through 11 in particular. And I highlighted all of those. I think you should, too. It's a passage you want to be able to find rather readily. It's verses 10 through 14. Any man from the house of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood, and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I've given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement. Therefore, I said to the sons of Israel, no person among you may eat blood, nor may any alien who sojourns among you eat blood. So when any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them in hunting catches a beast or a bird which may be eaten. Now see, Bill, this is not a sacrifice now. Previously it was the sacrifices. Now you're just out hunting for the family. He shall pour out at the end of verse 13 its blood and cover it with earth. For as the life of all flesh, its blood is with its life. Now you see, I skipped the italicized words. They're helpful in this case, but weren't in the original. For as for the life of all flesh, its blood is identified with its life. I don't particularly care for identified. That kind of makes it a little more distant, almost symbolic. But that's not the case. The life is in the blood. So 14, as the life of all flesh, its blood is with its life. Therefore I said to the sons of Israel, you are not to eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. Now, this is a biggie. Make sure you make a note in your margin of your Bible at verse 10. Acts, book of Acts, chapter 15, verses 28 and 29. Now, in Acts chapter 15, of course, we will find the very first New Testament epistle, New Testament book. It's not a standalone book, so I can't tell you to turn to thus and such a book. We find it included in the narration of Acts chapter 15. So in Acts chapter 15, let's turn on down now to verses 28 and 29. So I'm skipping all the context, you know, and circumstances, but let's just get to the letter itself. Well, if I turn another page, I'd have Acts 15, so that'd make more sense to me too. All right, so 23, see, they sent this letter by them, the apostles and brethren who are elders, and so there's you know, much that goes on there. We're just going to read the last two verses of this letter. Verse 28, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. So we have these apostles and elders in consultation. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these essentials, that you abstain from things sacrificed to idols. So he tells them, if somebody's offered something to an idol, don't eat it. Will Paul later tell the Corinthians that you could eat it? Yes, you can. It's not actually, you know, a sinful thing. But here, at the very beginning, and with these Gentiles, he's telling them, you need to abstain from that. Of course, it'd be a good idea forever, but Paul will clarify it later with further explanation that it's not actually a sin, but it's still a good idea to abstain. Now, the second thing is that you abstain from blood. We just read why. So at verse 28, you want to write Leviticus chapter 17, verses 10 through 14. There's the grounds and foundation stone. As a matter of fact, it's in Genesis 2, but I'm out of time. So it's always been this way. From Genesis through Leviticus to Acts, the life is in the blood. So you abstain from things sacrificed to idols and from blood and from things strangled. If a thing has been strangled, has it been bled out? No. So really, again, this appears to be involving the fact that you're not draining the blood. So you're consuming the blood. The life is in the blood. This is an abomination. I'll cut you off if you do this. The third thing is, well, the fourth thing, rather, I'm sorry, is from sexual immorality. Fornication's okay, but again, it's that word porneia that we've been talking about in the last couple of classes and will be the first order of business next time we meet. From fornication, if you keep yourselves free from such things, you will do well. Farewell. So, you answer the question. Can Christians eat or drink blood? No. Many people and cultures do, but it is particularly odious to us. It's one of those icky things, you know, from a previous class. But it is ingrained in us, brethren, because of our nation's familiarity with Scripture. And so we are very squeamish about these things because we are a people who came aborting into this new land, you know, with Scriptures in hand. And that's right. That's very good and that's appropriate. You'll find some that will argue with this. They'll maintain, no, indeed, you could. I'm not one of them. I'm quite convinced these things are still so. Okay, well, thank you. I know it was a race, but important to keep those two chapters together because he mentions atonement. It's all about that blood. I'd keep the two together. And thank you for your extra minute. Be safe out there. I'll not see you on Sunday. Have a good night.